The two parties are equally important. I'm here to give value. You're here to give me money in exchange for my value. So without me, you ain't got any company. Without you, I ain't got any job. So that means without me, you don't have HR. What are you HRing, if I want to use that word? So thank you so much for that question, Omawomi. It's great to be here. Sorry about that technical glitches. Okay, so what important factor should be on your CV? For me, I think that, so I'm speaking with respect to the age that we're in now, because I always believe in contextualized practice, which is you gotta practice with respect to context. So what they told you in 2005 no longer works now. What you knew in 2010 no longer works now, right? And what you knew in 2015 may no longer work now. So the global pandemic taught us a lot of things, right? So the world is no longer flat. The world is flattest. So that means you can be found, you can be heard, you can be seen by anyone. Now, I'm sure you might be wondering, so what's the connection with this to the question? All right, so the connection there is that now people are beginning to move away from the primitive way of thinking, the traditional way of thinking, into some new level of thinking because of the new realities that we're in. So what important things should be on your CV are things, so it has to start with from a place of what is your strength, what are you looking out for, right? So if I'm looking out to take up a sales role and then I have lots of HR experiences, so how am I really going to prove to my employer that I can do so well, incredibly well, with this role? I've seen, gone are those days you put, I went to buy, so maybe you want to pitch yourself as an admin person. I clean the office desk. I buy toilet tissues. I buy this. I do that. I book flights. Nobody cares about all of that. You've got to start looking for roles that positions you as a person of value to the employer. So let's say you did something in the admin department that contributed to the efficiency and effectivity of running the organization. That is what you should put there. So don't say, I stocked up the office, I bought tissue. Nobody is interested in those are admin stuff, but nobody's interested in that. So what should you put on your CV at any level, whether you're at entry level or you're mid level, it should be things that contribute to the baseline. I think anybody looking for a job should start thinking like the owner of the company. That's how to think. So when you think that way, you begin to put things that contribute to the efficiency and productivity of the organization. And then that's how you begin to declutter your CV and remove the things that are not necessary. And there are some experiences that should not be there. People say you can't have one CV. So you might want to apply to this industry for this certain role. You want to position yourself. Like for me, I work in an industry, automobile industry, right? But I manage learning, development, and performance, right? So I also want to position my learning integration as to how it contributes to sales, because where I currently function is a sales driven organization. So you want to position that you have the right tools to unlock sales, because they are thinking sales, right? So that's how you want to start thinking. And that's how I really cannot tell you blanket things to say, put this on your CV, do not put that on your CV, from the principles I've shared, which is, how does this contribute? So everybody pull up your CV and ask yourself, experience one, how does this contribute to effectivity and productivity. If it doesn't, take it out. Experience, you begin to look at every of those things and then you begin to declutter. And then lastly, I think you should start learning how to summarize your experience. You know, stop listing 55 things you did whilst you were working as a sales officer. We don't need all of that. Nobody wants to see all of that, right? Someone wants to look at your CV and make a decision. The time it hiring decisions, especially for maybe mid-level, entry-level, nobody has all that time. If they are hiring you as a CEO, fine and good. So they have to take their time, you know, go circle back with lots of people. But if they are hiring you mid-level, junior level, nobody has all the luxury of time to start reading your 55, you know, activities that you did in the previous, you know, organization. So focus on what you should focus on. Summarize it to project yourself as a person of value. I hope that helps. Thank you. Thank you so much, Omomi, for that question. So I'll use an example of a friend. You know, she's currently, you know, a sales expert, right? You know, so we got talking, and then so I was trying to get into her story. How did you get into sales, you know, and everything? And then she said that, Victor, I used to work as a front desk officer, you know, but I knew that I could sell. And when I was working as a front desk officer in a multinational, right, you know, so an interview came up for a sales role. And it came up within the organization, right? And then she found out that most of the things that she was doing, even from the front desk, right, she was taking up lots of things that were sales inclined. And then she applied, you know. So, I mean, she was not this regular front desk that would just practice, oh, you're welcome, sit down, who are you here to see, and all that stuff. She knew that that was her reality, but that wasn't her destination. So she did not allow her reality to color where she was going. So she did beyond the role of a front desk officer in that multinational. People wondered, why are you taking up so much? You know, and then she was doing a lot of sales stuff. She was even going to the field with them at some point, you know, whenever she can, you know, get into the field. When they come back, they analyze, she joins their sales meeting and all of that. So when the role came up, she applied, right? And guess what? She was able to pitch herself and her CV in the light of the things that she has done that is in context with what she was looking for. Guess what? She got hired as a sales manager. That was how she moved from, that was so, so incredible, from a front desk executive to a sales, one of the sales manager in the organization, right? Because she was able to project herself in that light on her curriculum vitae, you know, by virtue of having that chat with her. Because really, beyond all the jargons we write on our CV, right, what you exude, your what you speak, it's a product of what you have. So that you write it is doesn't mean that you have it. People just think that, it's not about writing it. So when I have a conversation with you, the words that you're speaking, the frequency of your thought pattern, the how you're weaving your words, it's going to tell me whether you've got it right. So I agree with what, you know, Toyin has shared. You know, you want to make that switch from maybe a logistics person to a HR person. Maybe you've been doing more of stuff that has to do with HR. You can actually make that switch, you know, project yourself in that light. To whatever, to your prospective employer, in the way you craft your CV, and also more importantly, in the way you speak. Because when they have a chat with you, they want to understand your process of thinking and how you think and how you speak. That will reflect. Thank you.
Thank you, Victor. So on to the next question.
Session. But I think that. So I'm going to say it in the stance of. I want to be careful. So what I'm saying means literally, go to hell, right? I mean, that's what it means, literally. I mean, when you want to look at it. So, but I'm going to paint it in a very professional way. We can't say go to hell in an ethical session like this, right? But what it means is that actually, you know, those people, and I'm going to talk about that, right? So the career that I want and the career that my parents want for me, this is where, that's the issue. I mean, that's something we're even trying to address in my industry of coaching and all of that. Where a parent is supposed to be a coach, you're supposed to look at the child and you're supposed to guide the child, not dictate for the child, right? And I'll share an experience. My parents wanted me to do medicine and surgery. I wrote JAMB thrice because of that. You know, after I settled for health, I did health, you know, public health. And then when I was done, they were like, okay, so, you know, you didn't really do medicine and surgery, so you have to really now do medicine and surgery. And they wanted me to do a master's in public health, MPH, so that I'm closer to medicine and surgery. And then along the lines, I realized that, right, I wanted to do what I was doing, human development. I mean, I didn't know what it was called. I mean, I just wanted to move people from this point to this point, right? And you can do that through public speaking, what people call motivational speaking. You can do that through maybe acting. You can do that through singing. I mean, there are several ways you can do that. You know, you can even go start a church or become a pastor or something. But I realized that I want to do that through coaching, right? You know, so I had paid for my master's to start. Like, I had paid for the, purchase the form and everything. I think it was a few days to start, and I went for an event. I came back, I told my parents, hey guys, I'm no longer doing this master's. I busted it. And I went to do what I wanted to do. The thing about, so whoever is asking this question, if you're in this room or if you have a similar situation, what, it's not even about your parents. The moment you allow people, right, to say, go do this stuff. And that's where I always kick against mentors doing this a lot. Mentors, you're not supposed to tell mentees stuff. You're supposed to guide them, galvanize for them to find their real essence. It's everybody's responsibility on this session to understand what you were wired and fired to do. It is nobody's responsibility. So nobody's going to come. And you can't Google. It's not Googleable. You can't say, Google, what should I do? What career path should I do? It's not something you Google. It's something you ask yourself, right? You begin to look at the kind of person that you are, the kind of things that makes you ick, the kind of things that really interests you. We begin to narrow down lots of these things, and then you begin to zero in, what path should I follow? So it's not about, you know, I mean, you think about it. I didn't have a say in the school I was supposed to study. I didn't have a say, right? I mean, I just woke up. I found myself in KG1. Nobody asked for my opinion. Nobody asked me, hi, Victor, you know, which school do you want to go to? They didn't ask me that, you know? They didn't even ask me before they brought me to this family. Nobody asked me, do I even want this family? So why would I leave my career path, something that is long-term? I'm not, because career is not a job. It's a long-term job, something you want to do for the rest of your life. You don't want to leave that decision in the hands of anybody, right? So if you're here, you want to do law and your parents want you to do medicine and surgery, it's tough. Like my mentor Gary Vee will say, if you live in their house and you eat their food, you might need to stop doing that and go find your own house and your own food, right? Because it's really going to, I mean, I've had to coach lots of people where, Victor, you know, my dad has told me, if I don't study medicine and surgery, or if I don't get a job in this line, or if I don't pursue this path, then they're going to disown me. I mean, we had a case. The parents were going to disown that person because they didn't want to study that. So it's just like someone telling you who to marry. Because what happens is they are not going to be there after you made that choice. You want to make a choice that you want to be responsible for. Okay? Except if you're confused, you want to seek advice, you want to seek counsel. But guess what? That decision, what should I do? Because when you look at that question, it is, what should I do? Not what should people do, what should I do? You are the sole actor. You are the sole actor in that. And so it's incredibly important that you begin to ask yourself critical questions. And usually I always have some checklists to really help lots of people in this, you know, part, because it's more like purpose and all of that. So you want to look at who am I, want to look at what problem, you know, were you born to solve? You want to look at, you know, things around, what are the things that you look around, you know, it sort of like affects you. For me, I want people to succeed. I started organizing classes way back from 100 level when I got into school. I just wanted people to succeed so badly. My success comes from the successes of other people. And I found that it was something that I was really passionate about. And I began pursuing a career in that. So I think you want to really look at yourself and ask yourself some critical questions. People might guide you on that path, but you have to make that choice. Life and death, it was the good book that says it, you know, life and death is in the power of the tongue. So it means that you have to make that choice. Not your parents, not your mentors, not your counselors, not anybody. So that tomorrow, you're not going to say, my parents. I've had some people say, hi, Victor, it was my dad that put me through studying psychology. I didn't want to do psychology. I wanted to act films. I wanted to be a movie star. So, and then that's where all these blame games are coming. Later on in life, we have damaged lots of people because we wanted them to do something that we thought was good for them without actually finding out what they were wired. Because once you're not in your essence, you're going to be frustrated. You're going to be confused. You can become a doctor. I've met frustrated doctors. I've met confused nurses. I've met disorganized, you know, lawyers, right? So it's not about the profession. It's about you. You can be a doctor and then you are so frustrated. So pursue that path that you're wired, that connects to your essence. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Victor.
Thank you so much, Amaomi, for that question. When I saw this question right, I began also self-musing around it to say, what exactly have you been doing from when you started out your career? So I don't know who this person is. I'm assuming, so it's an assumption, right? I'm assuming that you didn't just start your career at age 30. All right, so I want to answer this question on that assumption. So because you want to switch career, you know, from what you used to do to something else, but because of the age barrier and all of that. So, I mean, I'm in my late 20s, right? So, and I want to make a switch. I want to switch to another career path. I must have been doing something, right, that qualifies me to be able to pitch myself in the new career path, okay? Because I mean, there are rules and there's the way things work in the professional industry, right? You can't just appear and say, oh, I'm here now, given the job, right? So it's about value. It's about value proposition. So you are not I don't know how to put it now. So you are not 007. Oh, I'm here now. So where's the job? Let's get it. No, that's not the way it works, right? So it's about value exchange. So if I'm 35, right, and I used to be in a sales-driven role and I've done sales, you know, from when I started my career till up until now, and I want to, you know, transition into, let's say, my industry, learn and development, learn and development coaching and all of that. So I must have been able to be building competency under the radar. And that's why I'd like to tell young professionals, don't restrict yourself. In fact, it's small thinking to restrict yourself, you know. The host muted me. I hope I've not said something that they want to off my mic. I don't know. These days of offing mic.
I was hearing some background
noise. Okay, so is it HR of Lagos that offed my mic? Because we don't seem to be on the same page.
Yes, it was HR of Lagos.
We don't seem to agree. Okay, all right. So, and I absolutely do not care about that, right? So it's not important, even if we don't agree. Okay, so you're welcome, HR of Lagos. All right, so like I was saying, I'd like to tell young professionals, it is smallness of thinking, it is limitational in thinking to restrict yourself to your job role. to restrict your capacity to your job responsibility. Oh, I'm supposed to come here, turn on the computer, call 100 people a day, close the computer, 5 o'clock, off I go. Once you do that, what you have done is to restrict, you know, your future opportunities. You want to ask. And I mean, I always tell employees, find out, so you are in sales. What exactly is happening in procurement? What is happening in HR? What are they doing there? Nobody said be a busybody, but have a little knowledge about what is happening in this up. Because as you are working, you begin to find out that you have some flair for some certain things that were not there. And thank you, Toin, for putting some level of balance, you know, to the earlier question. And what I would like to say at this juncture is, you're not supposed to figure out what you're supposed to do the rest of your life. People just say, someone told me I locked myself, I'm looking for purpose. I say, what's your problem? That's why you are stuck. You're looking with purpose. You're not supposed to know your purpose. You're not even supposed to figure it out. You're supposed to be on the move, tasting and testing. So today I'm testing HR, tomorrow I'm testing. You're testing lots of things. I mean, when you're still young. So when you're working in a certain role, so for this person that is already 35 or 36 or 31 or 30 to 39, I want to ask a question, which is, what have you been doing under the radar? Right. So if you're transitioning from from industry X or from niche X to niche Y, have you been building some level of competency for niche Y? Because in work, nobody cares about who your father is, or nobody cares about that. It's value exchange, except you belong to, I don't want to mention that. So, but it's about value exchange, which is, what value are you bringing to the table? It's not about I'm beautiful or I have a fine voice. No, except if fine voice, it's a value proposition for the required role. So it's about value. Always remember that. So if you're here and you even want to transition to another, you know, industry in the next 5 years, start now and start building the competency. Begin now. Begin early enough. Begin early enough. Right. Begin early enough. Start understanding what is happening in that industry and how do I move myself. Right. And I'll wrap up with this. This is why so many people get so shocked. Oh, I released a song and the album did not sell. Do you think that you just wake up and enter the studio and just sing stuff and then you have 2 million sales? Who born you? Who are you? Where do you come from? How do you exist? You don't do that, right? You really have to understand the industry. You have to start practicing what I call little drops of water. So you are dropping water. You are dropping water. You are dropping water. In the next 7 years, it's going to become a mighty ocean. And that's the ocean of knowledge, of competency, of capacity that you're going to use to pitch for value in that industry. So this person, wherever you are, I don't know if you've got some competency or some value you want to use to transition. It's not about age. It's not about that. Right. The thing is, it's just because I may just scatter the HR, whatever. You can actually get some offers. Forget all this, must be 26. Leave all of that. If you know how to work around it and you are a person of high-end value. My first ever job, right, I went far above the starting salary. They said, Victor, we can't pay you this. This is not what every junior staff is earning. My first work after NYS, I told the HR person that, listen, I am not here to negotiate what every junior person is earning. I am here to negotiate on the terms of my value. So I don't know the value they have brought to the table. You are paying them starting, so you don't tell me your starting salary. I tell you my starting salary because I know the value. So I can talk audaciously that way because I understand the value that I'm bringing to the table. I think it's even a place of we not knowing our worth and our value. If you don't understand your value, you are going to undersell yourself. You're going to have a hard time, you know, trying to sell yourself. So that's what I'll, you know, probably say to this person trying to make that transition. What value have you mopped up in those years that you want to use to pitch for that experience? So maybe I'll let Toin say a few things on this. Thank you. Thank you so much, Toyin. You brought so much context and perspective to that question. So I don't even want to come from that angle. I'm going to come from the angle of, so in my field of practice, right, there's a presupposition of neuro-linguistic programming that says every behavior has a positive intention. So there's always an intention for every behavior. So I want to come from the angle of, why do you want to transition to HR? Because oftentimes we've got warped intentions around stuff. So Toyin has shared the process flow, which is, I completely agree. You know, Wumi has, you know, lent some credence to that. So I want to look at, because you might get to HR and be more frustrated. Because the truth of the matter is, one day I said something around LinkedIn has become a HR environment. I mean, once you just open LinkedIn, I mean, it's just HR. So HR owns LinkedIn. There's HR. The owner of LinkedIn is HR. So there's really no argument around that. So, and lots of people come to my DM, you know, sir, I like what you do. I like HR. You know, I first of all say, I'm not in HR. You know, because there are lots of, I mean, just to shake them up a little. Because I always ask, so why do you want to come to HR? Why do you want to move to sales? Why do you want to move to marketing? The intention is important. You know why? You might get the process flow that Toyin has said. Brilliant stuff. You get into HR and you become more depressed. You say, ah, they didn't tell me these are the things. You get into HR, you become more, you begin to underperform. And then you're wondering, but I wanted HR, but the motive was dysfunctional. If the motive is dysfunctional, the outcome is going to be dysfunctional. If the motive is dysfunctional, right, the outcome is going to be dysfunctional. So start asking yourself questions around, when did I notice the urge to move away from my current niche to HR? What created that urge? What was the emotions I felt, I saw, and I experienced? How did this start? What happened? What are the events? You begin to write everything down. And that's how you discover the intention of things. Because it could just be that your friend in another, your colleague or your friend got to HR and got a raise and is doing so well. And then because of that picture, you know, the way our mind mirrors information, you can hear an information and then you say, it's nothing. But guess what? Your mind has processed that information and has begun to create energy around it. And then what happens is you begin to notice that you are now thinking around, because out of the abundance of, you know, your heart, what goes into your heart, you begin to think that way. Right. So I'm more concerned not about how to get to HR or marketing or sales. It's your productivity when you get there. And your productivity is a function of your intention. So if your intention is dysfunctional, you are going to struggle. So whilst you have the process flow, the technique, the tools from Toyin, which is something I strongly believe that will work for you, you know, you also want to look at the intention for doing that. Thank you. All right, so I'd like to approach this with a more practical, using myself as a case study, right? Just so if you can apply to your context. So, but before I share that, someone said something on Twitter, a friend of mine said that, I understand the pressure from piggy bank and cowrie wise and all of those, you know, money apps to save money. So he now said, but at times practice, if I perish, I perish. So what that means is, just take the last 5K in your account. Just go and buy pizza and Cold Stone. Finish it and just start watching Netflix. You know, don't bother about the future or anything. You know, so it was very funny. People were like, oh, I'm going to practice if I perish this week. Some were saying, oh, mine is on Thursday. Some said, oh, I just came out from practicing this. You know, so, and it was really fun, really, because there's always this pressure to really perform. There are times, you know, you literally wake up and then you binge on Netflix for the whole day, and that's performance. And then you don't feel guilty for, oh, I didn't do anything productive. So let's not even go there. So let me use myself as a case study. Whenever I'm going for interviews, the first thing I want to condition myself is to say, which movie do I have on Netflix that is really interesting I'm going to see? So I line up that movie, then I think that I failed the interview. Now, I'm not saying this might not work for you, but I go with the mindset that I wasn't selected for the role. That's what I do. So I fail before they fail me. So when you fail me, I failed. I mean, there's nothing you can do about that. So I go there with the mindset that they didn't pick me for the job. Guess what? I went to interview in a role. And then when I got into the lobby, people were wearing suits and everything. They were all shaking. I said, so I said, hey guys, good morning. You know, my name is Victor. Like, who is this one introducing himself? We are here shaking. You are talking. Please, I don't want to talk. I'm like, why? It's just an interview. And they were all nervous and everything. And I told them something. I said, guys, listen, two things will happen here. It's either they are going to select you for the job or they won't. You know, the outcome already. So there's no need to be afraid, you know. So, and when we got talking, and then there was so much, the pressure came down, the tension came. They were like, oh, wow, I've never thought about it that way. I said, yes, every interview has two outcomes. Sorry, we'll get back to you, which is, Toyin, you guys need to change your industry. Sorry, we'll get back to you means you are not selected. Toyin, you guys need to change your HR of Lagos. I'm calling you guys out. You need to change. You know, sorry, we'll get back to you, which is, go and look for
one. Why are you denying your colleague? This guy.
So the response is two, which is sorry, we'll get back to you, which means that go and look for another job. That's the in other words, right? Or you're hired for the role. So it's almost like when you go to the cinema, you want to go watch King of Boys, right? And then your friend has told you everything that happened. When you get there, I mean, if they want to kill somebody, I mean, you're not sure because you know the outcome. So I'm saying, in essence, before you go for that interview, know the outcome, which is I can either fail or pass. And then lastly, I always go with the mentality that, Toyin touched on this, right? They called me because they needed me. So I think job, if you're seeking for a job, let's disabuse this mentality around the person trying to interview me is more important. There is nobody more important. The two parties are equally important. I'm here to give value. You're here to give me money in exchange for my value. So without me, you ain't got any company. Without you, I ain't got any job. So that means without me, you don't have HR. What are you HRing, if I want to use that word? And without you, I'm not going to get into the work. So I think we need to start dusting up our value around these things, which is, I mean, because when you look at it, it's fear that causes, oh, I don't know what I'm going to say. So it's the fear of failure, which is, what if they don't pick me? So what if they don't pick you? No, what if they don't pick you? What about that? You go your way, right? So it means that, I mean, you try another opportunity. Okay, so for this person, like Toyin has said, yeah, you need to really jack up your confidence in terms of public speaking. You know, Toastmasters can help. It's a good recommendation. But again, you want to also look at this fear, because fear is an informant. We always dread fear. Oh, I'm so afraid. Being afraid is one of the incredible gifts of life. To be afraid, it's like you don't know what it means. To be afraid is a value. It's something we should really want to. You want to be afraid. If you're not afraid, then something is happening. Something is wrong somewhere. Meaning that the fear is telling you, you've not gone for this interview before. And guess what? Me, I don't know for Toyin, right? I still get cold feet, you know, when I want to sit before a panel, you know, something I've never done before. I still get the cold feet. And that's the thing. If Toyin wants to go work for, I don't want Toyin to feel now. Okay, what's the biggest? He can give me Fortune 500. So Toyin wants to go work for the highest, the top level Fortune 500. Guess what? What did you say?
World Bank.
I don't know if she likes that. We don't know what she... But anyway, Fortune 500. And everybody wants to be in Fortune 500. Okay. Goldman Sachs. And then Toyin wants to go to Goldman Sachs and work as the group head of HR. And then she has to sit with global CEOs and everything. She's going to have cold feet at the first instance. That cold feet is telling you that you've never done this before. You've got to prepare yourself to be able to do this. So fear comes to inform you. So if you take it as an information, and then like Toyin has said, prepare yourself. Go before a mirror. Join some groups, WhatsApp groups that will help you jack up your confidence. And the most importantly, my own formula is fail before you get there, which is I have failed the interview. So if I get there, you tell me I've failed, I will just laugh home. I've almost all my interviews, when I'm done, I go and treat myself. Wonderful, sumptuous meal. I don't care. I mean, I don't go around sobbing, oh, they didn't pick me. What's my own there? I go to a restaurant. I say, just give me anything, ice cream, every, just bring it. I enjoy myself and then I go home. Because I realize at the end of the day, right, that event does not determine me. You know, it's my response to those things that also determines my outcome. So that's where I go around it. Thank you so much. So I will say point blank, hold your teaching job, volunteer as a personal assistant so that you can validate that interest. When you validate it with a value chunk and you've mopped up some value, you can now go really work as a personal assistant. Because oftentimes too, like I said before, we are not really exactly sure what we really should do or what we want. So I always like to validate. So whilst you hold your teaching job, find someone that you want to assist personally as an executive assistant, as a personal assistant. There are lots of people, in fact, I'm even looking for one. So there are lots of people, right, that you can do that for free, so that you can understand to what extent of capacity and value that you bring to the table as a personal assistant. Now, when you know your worth and your value, you can use that to pitch for a job. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Victor. I think you said
a few years ago that I discovered that what I was doing is HR, which is why I always make that joke with HR of Lagos that really, I don't think I'm in HR, because I just want to develop people. I don't want any tag or anything around. So if it's in HR industry, so be it. So I didn't start out wanting to be in HR. I just wanted to develop people. And that was the goal. And if you're here, right, and you have younger ones at home, guess what? You're in HR. You're managing them. So let's stop. You don't need any job to be in HR. Now, you might say, okay, Victor, I'm the only son, or I'm the youngest. You are managing your own life. You are HR. So I think we need to call for a WhatsApp group meeting and say, what exactly is about HR? Because HR fundamentally means that you are human, and then you want to be able to galvanize people to be able to achieve a certain result. And you can do that from any department in your organization. Like Toyin has said, you don't have to be in HR. You can do that.
Fantastic.
You don't need that. So if it's a title, it's simple. We can just add HR to your name. Should be HR of Lagos. We can just... Yemeka even said there is Africa, there are other states. You can say HR of Abeokuta. Other states are not taken. Right. Now, I'm not saying this to downplay your question in any way. That's not what I'm doing, please. You know, I can really be very, you know, funny, and so I understand. So I can really be shady. But again, I'm just trying to say that let us get our perspective right. If it's about the function, the functionality, and I've met lots of HR people that are not even, they don't know a jack about HR. So I ask, so what are you doing? So I'm HR. So what are you doing exactly? So you can be in the title, because titles, so capacity trumps title. It is not about the title, it's about the capacity. So you can have the title of a manager, but you are being managed by your subordinates. You've not seen a manager that is being managed by their subordinates, right? So it's not about the title, it's about the functionality. So Toyin has, said it, it's important that we go back to why do you want to be a HR? Is it because of the title? Does it make you feel good? And we don't want to really downplay your feelings. If it makes you feel good, by all means. So if that's the reason you want to hang on to being in HR, by all means, you want to go for it. Right. So if it makes you feel a certain way, by all means. But why does it make you feel a certain way? Which is really, really important. Everybody, as long as you're born into the world, the first day you landed here, you became a HR person because you started managing yourself, started leading your life. And that's what human resources is about. So let's get these things in proper perspective. Wumi?
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Wumi, for that question. So there are two patterns of making profit. Either you generate revenue or you reduce costs. When you do that, you're making profit. And oftentimes, because of the functionality of human resource, so human resource is not at the front end, right? So, you know, so they are mostly at the back end trying to raise down costs and all that. So you want to also look at where you currently function up from. You know, what's your strength? There are about six key pillars of HR. Okay, you know, so if you're like, for me, it's learning and development. And I want to say, so if I'm asked that question, so we're going to reduce training costs by using internal faculty to implement trainings, you know, identifying some people within the business that can galvanize learning intervention. And that way we save money. We also do that by measuring direct productivity, which is to say, once this person goes through this learning path, what was their productivity in terms of numbers before, and then after the learning, this was, you know, you can justify that their performance, you know, went up. So you want to use all that metrics to say, okay, this is how we're able to generate profit for the business. So you're not going to be thinking around, we're going to go sell something, you know, because you are not in the front line. So HR is more like an internal, an overhead kind of stuff, right? So you want to use things around your strength, you know, to pitch that value, and looking at one of the core areas of HR. So if it's hiring, which is recruitment, if it's onboarding, you can save a lot of costs with onboarding if you understand, you know, some maybe digitalized methods or something, you know. So you just want to look at each of these core pillars and identify where your strength is and then pitch your value around that. Thank you. So I would think that, thank you so much, Wumi, for that question. That's an interesting question. I even personally think that at this junction, everybody put your hand on your head and say this prayer: I refuse to be entitled, you know, because there's a lot of entitlement culture that has eaten deep into our system. All right, so that's following from the previous question and everything. So to really deal with this particular question, right, why do they design salaries, why can they design structured salaries and all of that, as opposed to asking me for my expectation? Remember that work or a job is about value exchange, which is what value, which is why you see a role for sales, maybe business development officers, right? And they want to hire five people. Five of them are going to be doing the same thing, but they're on different payroll. Because of value proposition. Remember that job is about negotiation. I mean, everybody negotiates. That's the dynamics of life. Right. You go to the market to buy stuff. You want to negotiate. Oh, why is this 20,000? Why is it not 15,000? You want to negotiate. So you don't want to design value in terms of value offering in such a way where, it's not supermarket now, in such a way where it is blocked out to say you cannot negotiate. So because it's about value, everybody, based on their capacity, they are bringing in value at different levels, at different frequency, based on their level of experience. So why should it be the same? Why should it be structured? But what What I know is the correct practice is to put a range. Oh, okay, so for this role, the range is 200 to 350. So how much you're able to get out of the table is a function of your value proposition index, which is why some people go to interview and then they come out, oh, I would have asked for an extra 100K. Wow. You know, so they realize that they under asked for value. So you don't want to. So it can never, it can never be fixed. Remember I shared before that the first place I worked in, they had a fixed value offering for entry level roles as fresh out from NYC. But guess what? My value proposition, right, discredited that, because I got a value proposition that is going to triple the productivity, or is going to increase, jack up the productivity of that organization. And then they went up higher. So that tells you that people can go up higher. People actually can go up higher. So it's about how interested they want that thing. How bad do they want you? So you've got to make yourself. So let's flip that question and say, how can I make myself badly wanted? You know, just mention this guy. Is it Dari? You know, that guy is badly wanted. There is no sense of entitlement around him, right? He's taking, with his full chest, taking responsibility for his life, his career, his future. So let's flip that question and say, how bad are they going to want me such that they are able to jack up their offering? I believe when people tell me, oh, that offer, you know, it's a 5.6 million annual salary. I say, don't worry. When I get there, I know how to jack it up to maybe plus another 1.5 or 2 million. There's a way you do that. There's how to talk. There's how to position yourself. And these are the skill sets, you know, as we begin to wrap up this whole conversation. Right. These are skill sets that we have to begin to develop. You can undersell yourself. You can oversell yourself. I mean, you can shortchange yourself, right? It's wanting to know your value system. It's wanting to know your value. You know, what you have as value is another thing to know how to sell it. You know, it's another thing to know how to position it in the market such that it is badly needed. So I don't think anybody wants to put a peg on, say, oh, for VP level, it's 2.5 million monthly salary. You want to put a range and say, this is the range, right? So when you come to the table, so it's like a national cake. You come there, you take your bite. So it's how willing are you? How ready are you? How much are you willing to soak up? That's what matters. That's why you and your colleague, you might not be earning the same thing, because you went into the room and then you soaked up 50,000. And that was it. Someone went to the room, soaked up 150, and that was it, right? And I'll wrap up with a story, you know, in the Bible where, where a worker, somebody went out and called some workers and everything and said, no, I'm going to give you, they agreed one penny at the end of a full day's work, right? A full day's work, one penny. And then they agreed that. And then they started working. So when he got to like, let's say 9 to 5. So the guy was hired at 9 a.m. and he says, no, by 5 p.m. I'm going to give you one penny. And then the guy said, it's fine, you know. So at about 4 p.m., the CEO brought somebody to join in doing the same work. When they ended the work, guess what? They gave each of them one penny. And the other guy was angry. And the CEO said, why are you angry? You know, it's a Bible story. Why are you angry? I thought we agreed for one penny for a full day's work. What is your business that I'm paying somebody else that worked 1 hour for the same one penny? So if the guy said, no, one penny is not going to cut it for me. I'm bringing in so much value in a full day's work. I need 5 pennies. So flipping that question, that also goes to say, you must be able to take out how much you want from the table. Whenever you go to meet the HR people and then you're negotiating your job offer and all of that, you're on the table. You need to grab as much as you think that you are worth, you know, with respect to the value you're bringing and with respect to the role and the level of work you're going to be doing. Thank you.
question.
Yes, I did. I think it's on the chat box. What kind of HR analysis would sweep a CEO off his feet at an interview? So this is a very funny, interesting question. So I'm trying to understand, right? Thank you for whoever asked this question. So, but I'm trying to understand, what exactly do you mean by sweep a CEO off his feet? Because sweeping off feet can mean a lot of things, you know, depending on the context. Do you want to, are you trying to be able to say stuff that would get them to bring you into the organization? Or, you know, so I mean, maybe a little more context will do. I don't know who typed this question. I think it's, the person is in here. So can you give it a little more context so that I can really understand what sweeping off feet really means? Is to look at what analytics is, which is you're trying to show by data. So depending on what productivity means for that organization, right? So if it means more this, more that, less of this, less of, so you want to show that in the analysis. So I don't think I have, maybe Torin has, but I don't think I have, you know, a particular blanket or a particular specific. It's okay, this is the HR analysis you're going to do, you're going to give to the CEO that would help the organization or sweep the organization off their feet or sweep the CEO off their feet. You want to look at the journey. I think Torin mentioned something around HR, not also some HR professionals not paying attention to the bottom line, which is what we're doing, what is the connection to the bottom line, which is maybe, is he increasing more sales, making more profit, none of that. So some HR professionals can be so focused on that role of I'm hiring, I'm firing, oh, we're happy, we're increasing salaries, we're reducing salaries, we're tracking latecomers. You know, you can just be in that bubble and then you don't really understand how does your firing decision, how does your promotion, you can promote somebody and promote that person out of competence into incompetence, right? So you want to look at all of these things, and these are what you analyze in data to say, this is our analytics as it relates to the bottom line. Every CEO, and I would like to say this, right, there are three levels of thinking. You have process, you have people, and then you have performance, which is profit, which is numbers, right? So process people are mostly maybe front level, frontline people, junior staff. They want to start. So process can be, oh, you know, I resume by 8 o'clock. I struggled to get the boss. And then when I got to the office, you know, I responded to all my mails. I called customers, you know, wow. Someone can look at that and say, oh, you really tried. Wow. You are going to be so tired. But a CEO can look at that and say, so you made 100 calls. How many calls, right, resulted into selling our product? Because the CEO is not going to go to the board of directors to start saying, oh, our employees are trying so much. Man, they are making calls like mad. That's not what he's going to, or he or she's going to tell the board, right? So there's a level of thinking, which is people. That's where I function from. So I think from a people level, which is the balance between profit and process, which is to say, what would hinder this person from underperforming? You want to look at the internal psychology of the human person. And then the highest level is where the CEOs and the senior management play, which is why if you attend an executive leadership meeting, nobody's going to be talking about process and people there, right? You're going to be majoring more on numbers. Okay, so how does this reflect in our numbers? Okay, so this decision, how does it tie up? So you have to be mentioning numbers. Oh, 20%, you'll be hearing things like 20%, 20 million, 40 million, you know, 100% in sales. You won't be hearing, oh, somebody bought 10. No, don't tell us that. How does that increase our percentage in terms of numbers? So you want to project the analytics in such a way that when the CEO is looking at it, they are not looking at the level of work you've done alone. They are looking at the contribution of that work. And that's what productivity is. If productivity is that what your activities you are doing is creating a certain product, that means it is contributing to the baseline. So if it's not contributing, then you are just busy. And you can just be busy in HR, moving around, just being busy. But when they link it back to productivity of the organization, which is sales, which is maybe profit, whatever that means for your company, you are not productive. So I think that's the kind of thing you want to show in your analytics. How does our activities in HR department, how does it tie up? How does it, you know? Oftentimes I think, I was speaking to a senior HR, and she said, Victor, whenever I want to hire, you know, and the CEO always asks, why are you hiring? How does this hiring decision affect, you know? So they're always thinking about how does it affect the numbers? It's the numbers, it's about the numbers. And that's what you want to show in your analytics. Thank you.
And thank you very much, Victor.
Thank you also for the opportunity to come here.
Thank you so much. Because you
get a lot of info.
Time.
Thank you, Maomi.
For shedding light to several questions today. I really appreciate you all.
Thank you so much for inviting me here.
Have a wonderful rest of the day.
You too. Thank you. It was great to be here. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.